Okay, let me pray and we'll make a start. Heavenly Father, thank you for gathering us together in your name. And we thank you for placing us here as Christian men in this great nation. And we thank you for Stuart and others who help us to think about who we actually are and how our witness may be most effective in the context that we're in. Father, we pray for our mates, our friends, that they may come to know the love of Jesus. And we pray that you'd help us to know how to be your people in this place, that people might be attracted to the Lord Jesus and come to know him. We pray for Stuart now as he speaks to us in Jesus' name. Amen. Let's welcome Stuart up front.
Well, thanks, Ivan, and g'day, mates. I'm a bit sensitive about the title of my organisation. I didn't think there's anything wrong with History of Christian Thought and Experience. Everybody else does. And they all said, why not Christian Thought and Practice? But I wanted to say, just a minute, we Christians are too frightened of experience, and therefore I'm going to get people to study it. So that's what that was all about. Gallipoli, 7th of August, 1915. Private Percival describes how one man rescues his brother. One man was caught through the side of the head, severing his right ear, but not killing him. He lay in a dangerous position, right in line of a point from which some snipers were potting our lads. A man crawled out of our shallow trench and wormed his way along the ground to a position within a couple of yards from the man. Ping, zip, zip, bullets hit the ground. But the rescuer worked his way snake-wise until he got to the wounded man. Clumsily turning the man over, he shouted, "How's she going, mate?" There was no answer. He yelled, "Strike me pink, the poor bugger's just about out of it." And he began to drag him. He got a bullet through his ankle, but managed it at last, and we cheered him. He looked over and grinned. Shortly after, the rescuer was shot by the Turks, and his brother lasted 2 days. The most decorated of all infantry soldiers in the so-called British armies of World War I was Harry Murray from Evandale in Tasmania. He won the Victoria Cross, 2 Distinguished Service Orders, the Distinguished Conduct Medal, and the Croix de Guerre. And Murray wrote years afterwards that discipline got him through. Not the parade ground discipline, of which the English were so fond, but the discipline that said you must not give in to natural instincts like fear, that rather you must look after your mates, that you had a duty. Mateship is a duty. The natural instinct of fear, he said, made you lapse in times of extreme danger into an every-man-for-himself philosophy. But the discipline of mateship, forged out of the sacred traditions of the AIF, meant that though the Hun was in hot pursuit, with bayonets fixed, you would always stop to help a wounded comrade. As Harry Murray jumped over another Australian soldier who he thought was dead, he just unfortunately happened to notice that this guy's eyes fluttered. And he later recounted with double modesty, "It was really only the mechanical habit engendered by strict discipline that forced me to do what I did. I dropped onto my shaking knees, caught him by the arms, and pulled him onto my back. He helped me like a hero with his one sound leg, and off we staggered, with Fritz just coming into our bay." William McInnes, who played John Curtin on the ABC in April this year, he took his children on a holiday through Western New South Wales. And he said, "I was extraordinarily moved by the sense of time and achievement since European settlement. I felt proud of the achievements of our shared history, of things such as the Flying Doctor Service and the work of Flynn of the Inland. At the bottom of a 400-metre mine shaft in Broken Hill, I listened with my children to the history of the three old miners. Where once the economy of this nation was ripped from the earth, now a group of tourists listen to the histories of these battered and noble Australians." "You need mates down here, you know," said Bob Murphy, "and a mate is basically someone you trust. You may not understand them, they might not look like you, you may not even know them that well, they may talk different to you, but if you trust them and they can trust you, then they're mates. Never has the concept been better described to me," he said. Mateship. So we're talking here about an Australian value. It was forged very early in our history, and I think if there's any value in this talk today, it will be to get you to appreciate how unconsciously, subconsciously, you have been influenced by your history in a way that you probably don't even appreciate. It has strongly shaped the Australian male, making us who we are. It's become a discipline with a force of an instinct. It has made us very loyal to our mates, but a little bit intolerant of those we don't feel fit that category. Mateship has made us courageous in adversity, yet fearful in intimacy. Was it more useful in the 19th century, perhaps, when its character was forged, than it is in the 21st century, now that it's getting old? Is it now more of a hindrance than a help, a hindrance to the achievement of happiness and love, which we would all like, and to inclusiveness and tolerance, which all communities need? So let's first of all define the term, then we'll review the history, then we'll thirdly explore the sense in which it's a religion, guiding behaviour and fitting us to live well. We'll then fourthly attempt to make an evaluation of its strengths and weaknesses. We'll have a look fifthly at the relationship between mateship and sexuality, and we'll conclude sixthly with some thoughts on how to preserve its strengths and minimise its weaknesses, by which time it'll be Monday morning. The Macquarie Dictionary defines mateship as a code of conduct among men stressing equality and friendship. The Australian National Dictionary defines it as comradeship as an ideal. On your computer, if your US, your United States English spell checker is on, when you type the word mateship, it will be underlined in red. It's obviously not an American term. Their closest equivalent is probably buddy, a word which is catching on here a bit. The younger generation are replacing the word mates with guys, which is more gender neutral. Girls call each other guys, and they call each other buddy too. Anyway, in the Oxford English Dictionary, most of the examples of the usage of the word mateship are taken from Australian sources, and we're told that it is now chiefly Australian. It's actually not a term which is Australian in origin. It seems to have come from a German word meaning meat, as in messmate, or one who eats meat with you. It was used by the English working class to describe members of their own class, but it's become Australian by adoption. Here in Australia, it's applied to everybody. Secondly, how and why it evolved, the history of mateship. In surveying the history of whole idea, we're really looking at the core of Australian social history. Mateship was, as I've said, an early starter in our history. In 1847, a book was published entitled Settlers and Convicts. It was written by one Alexander Harris, who observed of two men in the early days of the colony of New South Wales, quote, working together in the otherwise solitary bush, habits of mutual helpfulness arise, and these elicit gratitude, and that leads on to regard. Men under these circumstances often stand by one another through thick and thin. In fact, it's a universal feeling that a man ought to be able to trust his own mate in anything. In a nation with great gender imbalance, it was an antidote to loneliness, but the gender imbalance did not last. By the second half of the 19th century, the number of women caught up with the number of men. Why then did mateship continue when men had access to women to meet their biblical need not to be alone? Well, this is where the story gets interesting. When gender balance was achieved, males continued to socialise chiefly with males because of what is known as separate spheres ideology. In Australia, as in Britain and the United States, the most conspicuous cultural feature of the period 1850 to 1950 was that males and females inhabited separate and distinct spheres. The woman's place was in the home and in the church. Man's place was at work and in the public arena. The home became the repository of Christian values, and women were the guardians of those values. But it's interesting, it's arguable that this effect was more pronounced in Australia than in either Britain or America. Because Australia's early convict population was overwhelmingly male, as was its rural workforce, masculine-dominated culture became entrenched, and the Australian creed of mateship was elevated. Melbourne historian Marilyn Lake has suggested that two male types have competed for dominance throughout Australian history. See if you can work out which type you are. There's the lone hand, she said, and there's domestic man. The lone hand, she identifies with the masculine ideal written about by Russell Ward in that great book, The Australian Legend. The lone hand read the Bulletin magazine, drank copiously, gambled energetically, swore, and had an eye for womanising. And more than an eye, apparently. He inhabited a world without a wife or family, but not without women. Russell Ward commented on the frequency of sexual congress between pastoral workers and Aboriginal women. Indeed, Aboriginal women, because they afforded sexual pleasure without family responsibility, they were the perfect sexual partners. The partnership ended abruptly with ejaculation. The overwhelming evidence is that while some white men established lasting partnerships with Aboriginal women, the great majority abandoned the women and half-caste children. The effective champion of the lone hand was the Bulletin magazine, edited from 1880 by J.F. Archibald, who gave us the Archibald Fountain. He may have been, quote, the one Australian journalist of genius, but he was also an unhappily married, childless misogynist. He hated women. The Bulletin was very anti-woman. Women were vain, snobbish, parson-worshipping killjoys who schemed to trap men into wedlock. Domesticity, argued the Bulletin, sapped a man of his masculinity, and the Bulletin campaigned for divorce law legislation to allow men relief from the holy chains of matrimony. As the 19th century wore on, more women became available and more men married, but they carried the old attitudes into marriage with them. There was an observably high abuse of women and children by men who had been socialised into the lone hand mentality. Many men preferred to be with their mates on drinking binges, which they could not afford, and the incidence of malnutrition among wives and children in 19th century Australia was also observably high. Mateship was the creed of the lone hand type of male. It was not a creed which helped him either as a husband, a father, or a citizen. Then, on the other hand, there was domestic man. He had a different creed. He read the Methodist magazine. He supported temperance, family, and the church. He was a product of the cult of domesticity, the rise of which is attributed by historians to evangelical Christianity. And William Cooper, the evangelical poet, wrote, "Domestic happiness, thou only bliss of paradise that has survived the fall." The ideal of domestic man was consciously propagated by such organisations as the YMCA, which in the 1870s sought to extend home influence to all the boys in the colonies. And the relationship between these two types of males was not one of mutual respect. The lone hand branded the domestic man a wowser. By the end of the 19th century, the two sides, women and parsons on one side and real men on the other side, they were locked in a terrific political fight. Anne O'Brien, in a paper entitled A Church Full of Men, Masculinism and the Church in Australian History, argues persuasively, and I think this is very interesting, see if you can get this, that domestic man aspired to the qualities of the lone hand far more than the reverse. We males are far more interested in being identified with the lone hand types than we are than the other way around, even Christians. And even the competition between the two sides, it's a very masculine thing. And an ideology of masculinism was rampant in the church as much as in the realms of politics and business. And this might explain why women, who all over the world have had to struggle for equality in the church, as measured by ordination, for example, they found it particularly hard in Australia. In the Anglican Church in Sydney, women have shed many tears at the treatment they have received at the hands of blokey evangelical Anglicans who belong to a female-free club, which is the essence of mateship. I've known men who are astonished by all the crying from the women, but they suspect that all those tears, that's not playing fair. Mates don't cry. Tears were introduced into public life by Bob Hawke. And this signifies a new development in the history of mateship. And maybe mateship is something which is evolving and becoming more tearful. But we're running ahead of ourselves and dwelling too much on the negatives of mateship. If you did have a society with clear differentiation between the social roles of men and women, did mateship help the men, help the males to do better in their own particular sphere? And there can be little doubt, I think, that it did, especially in the bush, and as a way of achieving the essential mutual help in war, in dangerous occupations such as mining, and in times of national crisis such as floods and bushfires. It was a key to the character of the men who forged our national pride at Gallipoli. And writing from Gallipoli, war historian Charles Bean said, quote, "The West Australians assumed that death was certain, and each in the secret places of his mind debated how he would go to it. Mate, having said goodbye to mate, went forward to meet death instantly, running as straight and swiftly as they could at the Turkish rifles. With that regiment, went the flower of the youth of Western Australia. The First World War embalmed mateship with the blood of sacrifice and martyrdom. It became integral to Australian self-understanding between the wars. Thomas Dodd asked in the mid-1920s, "What is a mate nowadays? Someone you can rely on through thick, thin and middling, past hell and high water. In any trouble, you know what he will do without argument, because since he's your mate, it is exactly what you would have done yourself." Seems contradictory, doesn't he, your mate? He is. My Australian oath he is. Look at my mate. Take it from me. There was never such a pig-headed son of a twisted mallee root since mates were discovered. Yet I stick to him. I can't get rid of him. He's inside my skin. He's me. Bother him. That's what a mate is. He's me. Bother him. It helped take Australians through the Second World War. To mateship has been attributed the survival of many Aussies in the Japanese prisoners of war camp. And there the Australians discarded their differences and they became a tribe which was always the most successful group. We Australians survived best in prisoner of war camps than any other group. And the core of this success was an ethos of mateship and egalitarianism, which not only survived the ultimate dehumanising duress of the death camps, but shone through as the dominant Australian characteristic. We've been contrasted there with the Americans, who like to think about competition as being something which you take into war as well as into business at home. A mate was one who helped out in hard tasks such as land clearing and fencing. As such, it was a term which acquired its meaning in the bush and was transferred to the city. Australia is the land where most people live in the city with the values of the country. And one of those values has been mateship. And it survives where danger survives. Thursday Island Police Sergeant Graham Burridge was reported in the Courier Mail in August 2nd, 1999, as having said, quote, "It would take an awful lot of courage to jump on the back of a crocodile, but I suppose that's what you do for a mate." But in what sense is mateship a religion? It has been defined as a genuinely Indigenous Australian working class creed. We have not been very good at inventing religions in Australia, like the Americans do. They invent a new religion every day. But in Australia, we just stick to the old ones. But this might be a genuine Australian religion. How Christian was it? As we have seen, it tended to be the creed of those males who had trouble with the church, rather than of those who did go to church. But then, as now, those who did not go to church believed that they knew more about real Christianity than those who did go to church. Henry Lawson contended that mateship was the essence of Christianity. A true Christian, says the National Bard, was one who is sorry for most men and all women and tries to act to it to the best of his ability. And if he ain't a Christian, God knows what is, I don't. And Lawson insisted that the best Christian he ever came across was his dog, because his dog was his best mate. To Lawson, mateship was not only the essence of Christianity, it was also the answer to the problems created in society by the bickering churches. They march in mateship side by side, the Protestant and the Roman. They call no biped lord nor sir and touch their hats to no man. If mateship's a religion, how good a religion is it? Well, it's a very flat earth type of religion. It's not interested particularly in the heights or the depths. The Australian Mail, said D.H. Lawrence famously, after he'd been here for just 6 weeks and therefore knew all about us, have no interior life of any sort, just a long lapse and drift. And we Australian males, we do not look outside ourselves for inspiration. We suspect we haven't got much depth. We look outwards for vision to our mates and our physical activities. And therefore our chief religious substitutes have been mateship and sport, especially football, one brand of which is a great religion, because unlike soccer and rugby, it's all about getting high above the flat earth. Yeah. This is where the Pentecostal movement came from. From Aussie rules. Up there, Kazali. The official war historian C.W. Bean saw mateship as a national substitute for religion. And in the story of Anzac, he said, "The typical Australian was seldom religious in the sense in which the word is generally used. So far as he held a prevailing creed, it was a romantic one inherited from the gold miner and the bushman, of whom the chief article was that a man should at all times and at any cost stand by his mate." But mateship has not always been a force for consensus. T. Inglis Moore tells us that there are two types of mateship, just as there are two types of male. There's the inclusive type of mateship and the exclusive type, which brings us to consider the strengths and weaknesses of this value. As for the strengths, it increases the chances of survival in a physically dangerous world. It's directed against the hazards of or hardships of an environment, against loneliness, danger and death. And that's a positive thing, and it does appear to have served the same sort of social purpose in Australia as revivalistic religion did on the American frontier. It bonded people together to withstand physical danger, hence its great value in times of war. The inclusive brand of mateship is a force for democracy, at least among all men. It wasn't too hot on female suffrage. When it comes to hardships, we're all on the same level. We all need each other. Mateship tends to view all men as equals and is therefore a force for democracy. True, mateship inculcates a not entirely healthy understanding of democracy. Australian democracy is always about preserving our innate mediocrity as a people, our desire to resist differentiation and individual excellence. We like to think that we're all the same. I learnt this very early as a young fellow when I got into a taxi, and this guy had just been to hear Peter, Paul and Mary. Remember them? And he said to me, in the way blokes do, "Oh, Mary, you're all right, Mary." And, you know, she was smashing blonde, for those young fellas who don't know who Mary was. And she had hair which came across one eye like this, and she looked at you through one eye, and oh, you thought, oh, she was a scorcher. So I said to this taxi driver, I said to him, "So she's a bit of all right, was she, mate?" And he said to me, in all seriousness, he said, "She's no better than you or me, mate." And I thought, this is the stupidest thing I've ever heard. I mean, that I could get up there and sing like Mary and look sexy like Mary, this is stupid. And there is a. We are stupid at times. We are Australians. We really are. Because mateship is so Australian and so democratic in instinct, John Howard, you might have heard of him, he's the Prime Minister of Australia, you will remember that he wanted the word in the Australian Constitution. And in the preamble of the 1999 draft Constitution, John Howard approved of the words, quote, "We value excellence as well as fairness, independence as dearly as mateship." And this sparked a very interesting debate on the nature of mateship. By 1999, mateship was beginning to look politically incorrect thanks to the feminist movement. And Gareth Evans, who was then more frightened of the feminists than he was of Howard's mockery of political correctness, declared in a parliamentary debate on the Constitution, quote, "Mateship is a good and honourable word. It's a great Australian word. It is a quintessentially Australian word. Yes, it's all of those things. But the trouble is, it just does strike, on all the available evidence, the overwhelming majority of Australian women as too blokey and, accordingly, just not the right kind of word for this sort of document. The trouble is that our whole history has been too blokey, and women today and tomorrow just do not need a language in the Constitution reinforcing this kind of imagery." But the Prime Minister, he wouldn't have a bar of this. He said, "It is one word in all of this which is so unarguably, distinctively and dramatically and proudly Australian. I don't find that exclusively blokey, and I don't believe any fair-minded Australian understanding the history and the spirit of this country would either." So this is our beloved leader at his rhetorical best. But it's interesting that he does have to defend mateship against the charge that it was exclusive and blokey. At its best, it was not either of those things. But the problem is that it too easily slips below its best. I suppose it's like Christianity, really. 4 years later, Howard returned to his theme with an impassioned, elegant defence of mateship at a function in Australia House in London. This is great stuff, I think. "The two world wars exacted a terrible price from us. The full magnitude of that lost potential, of those unlived lives, can never be measured. And yet some of the most admirable aspects of Australia's national character were, if not conceived, then more fully ingrained within us by the searing experiences of those conflicts. None more so than the concept of mateship, regarded as a particularly Australian virtue, a concept that encompasses unconditional acceptance, mutual and self-respect, sharing whatever is available, no matter how meagre, a concept based on trust and selfishness and absolute interdependence. In combat, men did live and die by its creed. Sticking by your mates was sometimes the only reason for continuing on when all seemed hopeless. I was moved by an account written by Hugh Clark, who, like thousands of other Australian and British servicemen, endured years of senseless cruelty as a prisoner of the Japanese after the fall of Singapore. He couldn't recall a single Australian dying alone without someone being there to look after him in some way. That's mateship. Not since Henry Lawson has there been a stouter defender of the virtues of mateship than our beloved PM. But, unfortunately, going on to weaknesses, as T. Inglis Moore observed, there is another type of mateship which has been all too common, namely the exclusive type of mateship. It is divisive. It pits one class, such as the working class, or groups such as convicts, larrikins, bodgies or vandals, whatever the term is, against another. And here mateship creates a weapon which is used in community warfare. And precisely because it arose out of the experience of the bush and the war, it is not for everyone, because those experiences are alien to most Australians. Most Australians don't know anything about the bush and they've never been in a war. It has one doctrine, loyalty, and even that devolves easily into sentimentalism. Mateship is at its most degenerate in the beery brotherhood of the blokey barbecue brigade. I hope you like that. The beery brotherhood of the blokey barbecue brigade. Superficial, pleasant and harmless, unless you live next door to its devotees. One such blokey brother, Henry Lawson himself, slurred, quote, "The greatest pleasure I have ever known is when my eyes meet the eyes of a mate over the top of two foaming glasses of beer." And this manifestation of mateship has many faults. It's exclusive and divisive. Bosses could not be mates. You can't be mates with a boss. Mateship is foundational to Australian trade unionism. Unionism was mateship in an organised form, and unionism too was thought to have captured the essence of Christianity. Unionism, said W.G. Spence, founder of the AWU and a Christian, came to the bushmen as a religion. It had in it that feeling of mateship, which he understood already. Unionism extended the idea, unquote W.G. Spence. It's also been a racist concept. Chinamen could not be mates. In mateship speak, the expression, "he's a white man," came to mean he is a man of impeccable character. It's interesting how that is something which is passing, mercifully. It's also been sexist and misogynist. Women could not be mates. Superficial, it's that too, concerned to keep things on the surface. "Don't show the pain" is one of its slogans. If we do express our pain, it's to express our neediness, and it's therefore manipulative. "Never admit the pain, bury it deep, only the weak complain, complaint is cheap." And this inability to feel the true pain of our history is exactly what is catching up with us now. It leaves us deprived of compassionate feeling for the other in the special kinds of anguish that afflict society from time to time throughout our history. If you remember, we were pretty tough on AIDS sufferers when HIV first came on the scene. We were pretty condemnatory, weren't we? We're still judgmental about single parents abandoned to poverty. We're pretty hard on urban Aboriginals who say that's all their fault. The isolated elderly, the young unemployed, those people are not our mates, and all such tell their own stories about the violent exclusion that they feel. And mateship is neither visionary nor reflective, because it's not concerned about the future or the past, it's concerned with the present. "She'll be right, mate," is another of her slogans. And it's performance orientated, it's sport mad, and performance is seen as a solution to everything. Most of us men believe that we keep our jobs by performing. We don't see our own sacking in the making, because we do not realise that keeping a job is more about relationships than it is about performing. And perhaps most destructive of all, mateship inculcates what is called the hard culture. This is a label used by sociologists for the culture which has conditioned us men in Australia. They say that the hard culture socialises men in a narrowly masculinist way. That is why we've been keen to send our men off to war, far keener than the security of our country seemed to justify. The hard culture determines the attitude of Australian males to sport. Studies have shown that there is a great deal of pain associated with sport. There is little joy or playfulness, so we're told by the sociologists. They're a bunch of academics, and I don't know if I agree with them. But I must confess, in my old age, many of my aches and pains arise from the football injuries I incurred in the first in the few short years when I was stupid enough to play rugby instead of the real game. Winning at all costs becomes the object of the exercise. Australian males turn everything into a competition of egos, even heckling. But it's very enjoyable, isn't it? Ah, dear. Football is changing us. I was at the Swans the other day and I sat next to this guy who didn't talk to me the whole time. And I thought this guy is some sort of emotionless nerd. And when the Swans won, he jumped to his feet and he belted it out with incredible enthusiasm. We're told that men in Australia don't like singing. What crap? Boy, you should hear the choir at the Swans. The only thing is that the Swans players themselves can't sing, can they? That's terrible singing. They should get some choral training, I think. There are numerous pathological indices which show that the hard culture is a problem for the Australian male. Age distribution graphs show that for every age, more women reach that age than men. Men die more quickly. They suffer more physically. They are more overweight. They die more in accidents. More than 75% of drivers in multiple car crashes are males. Although the only one in my family who's been that has been my daughter. She hit the accelerator instead of the brake. And she hit the car in front of her, which 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 hit the car in front of her. And I had to deal with all of them. That's mateship. We men have a far higher permanent disability from work. We're far more inclined to serious assaults. We make far more use of illicit drugs than women, and yet women use more medical services than men. So women have more opportunity too, but we men succeed more. Men are much greater users of alcohol than women, and recent studies of university students living in student residences have shown significant levels of brain damage due to alcohol consumption. I reckon in 10 years' time, colleges will not allow alcohol, because we're now proving from studies made of the impact of alcohol on the brains that it kills them, particularly in adolescence when the brain starts to develop late and it never recovers. And you can now measure this. And I think that the fact that this is not better known is one of the greatest successes of the liquor lobby in Australia, which is an incredibly effective organisation. Anyway, it's almost too hard to be a male in our society, according to all those indices. The hard culture is a hard culture for males, and the mateship which produces that is not a helpful survival mechanism. It actually threatens our survival. I don't suppose that because it can be misused, that proves that mateship has gone off the boil as a helpful value in our society. But like religion, mateship can be used hypocritically. It can be used insincerely as a mechanism to con someone. Bill Hayden says that when someone wants to put the knife into you in the Labor Party, they say, "Oh, mate, mate. Mate, mate." And they respond to your suspicion with, "Mate." Hayden says that when they call you mate in the Labor Party, it's just like getting a kiss from the mafia. Have you noticed that Kevin Rudd calls everyone mate? He does. It all depends on context, though. Mate is a greeting that someone uses between mates who are pleased to see one another. Mate! Practice that. It's good. Mate! A similar destructive application of mateship can also be found in the Christian church. Gordon Moyes has recently made a furious attack on the Uniting Church on the occasion of its 30th birthday. There's not much to celebrate, according to Gordon, because the church is led by ecclesiastical politicians whose main business is arranging for their mates to run the show. According to him, mateship is not a great foundation for running an efficient, godly organisation. Churches should be run not by your mates, but by God's mates. Mateship and sexuality. In recent years, this has been aligned with homosexuality. Robert Hughes in The Fatal Shore says that by the 1830s, owing to the lack of women in Australia, mateship expressed itself in homosexuality. He confessed that it has not left much official evidence behind, but it was flourishing all right. We have to believe it, even though there's no evidence. D.S. Lawrence. That's right. D.H. Lawrence, in his novel, Australian novel Kangaroo, depicted one of his characters as stirring, quote, the latent power that is in man today to love his near mate with a passionate, absolutely trusting love. And Miriam Dixon, in the book The Real Matilda, suggested that mateship was constituted out of sublimated homosexuality. Probably the same conditions which produced mateship also produced homosexuality, namely the absence of women, but that doesn't prove, at least to my satisfaction, that mateship is an expression of homosexuality, sublimated or otherwise. Mateship, however, does seem to presuppose a womanless world. One mate suggested that women are like possessions. They come between friends. That's what women do. They come between friends. And women have been its chief critics. The mateship tradition, observed Judith Wright in 1965, leaves the relationship with women out of account. And this brings us to examine what might have caused the decline of mateship, seen as a masculine value for the benefit of males, if indeed it has gone into decline. The major cause may have been the feminist movement. Feminism, however, now may be off the boil, and maybe mateship is on the way back. I get the impression that feminism was stronger in the 80s and 90s than it is now, and maybe mateship is really enjoying a resurgence at the moment. And maybe if it is, then we need to make sure that it's a mateship which is more Christianised than it was before. Just a decade ago, the blokey exclusive style of mateship was looking decidedly unwell, and the social researcher Hugh McKay argued that Australians in the 1990s were in the grip of the big angst, he called it. The problem was not economic recession. That only kicked us when we were down. The problem was that we were in a pioneering phase in our history, he said. We were reinventing Australia in the 1980s and 90s by redefining our identities, and we were doing that in response to major social changes: gender roles, marriage, employment and the work ethic, credit, cultural identity in the face of multiculturalism, and politics. And of these seven major social dimensions, McKay contended that the first, namely gender roles, was unquestionably the one which had the most impact on us, and the one which of itself was almost sufficient to explain the current anxiety in our society. Women had been motivated to enter the workforce not only by economic necessity, but by their conviction that paid work is the essential symbol of their own liberation. Men have generally not shared this conviction at the emotional level and were very slow to adapt to the new definition of gender roles. Feminism changed the world for men as well as women. It succeeded in making some men, namely the white, affluent, tertiary educated, heterosexual intelligentsia, especially in the United States, where feminism was most extreme, but also in other advanced capitalist countries such as Australia, it made all of us feel mighty guilty. They bewailed their own past sexism, flirted with the feminism, and humbly followed the nearest woman's lead in everything. And one Australian sociologist, Connell, was not impressed. He said, doing a series of back somersaults is not a strong posture from which to confront the patriarchal power structure. I don't think we're as convinced today as we were then that the patriarchal power structure needs as much confronting as those who speak of the patriarchal power structure. But there is little doubt that feminism did lead the male to greater self-understanding. We men are now far more aware that masculinity is chiefly about power relationships among ourselves, and we have found that masculinity is more important to men than femininity is to women. And we men were increasingly and often justly reproached for our delinquencies as fathers. Mateship is no guarantee of effective fatherhood. So to conclude with a Christian evaluation, and then you can tell me what nonsense I've been talking. I won't answer questions, but I'll be happy to hear what you say. The Australian experience of mateship is worth reflecting on because it does help us to explain why Australian males have difficulties with women. And I'm very interested in the subject of revival. And someone said that revival is all about how, because it's something which is required to get males converted, that it's something which is the result of the problems which males have with females. That's what revival is all about. But I think that if that's true, then there would be religious revival all the time, wouldn't there? Anyway, to explain why Australian males have difficulty with women, why we have difficulties with sex, family life, with church, and even with the workplace, since we tend to think of it more in terms of performance than of relationships. By definition, mateship is about relationships between males. But it also explains why relationships between males in Australia might not be as rewarding or fulfilling as they might be. Clearly, there is a need to guard against the negatives of mateship, such as its exclusivity, its intolerance, its superficiality and insensitivity to the needs of women and children, and to go beyond mateship into deeper intimacy, more concern about the future and things of the spirit. But there is also the need to preserve what is good about mateship. So let's conclude by, on a positive note, by looking at these positive things. Mateship is about male bonding. And male bonding is actually essential to mental health and social happiness. And it can, after all, be huge fun. It doesn't hurt to love your mates to the point where you put their own happiness before your own, to be there for them no matter what, and to be loyal and trustworthy in friendship. He was a great mate. That might not be the best thing to have on your headstone, but he was a true and loyal friend. That's not too bad, is it? And mateship does give us plenty of inspiring examples of faithful, undying friendship. Mateship's morality is also admirable in as much as it controls conduct. The power of any value is its power to control conduct, and that is what gives it authenticity. And mateship is justifiably sceptical about elaborate professions, which particularly come from parsons and Christians, which are all words and no action. Mateship demands action. There is also something admirably practical and pragmatic about mateship. It deals with things as they are in the immediate present. At Gallipoli, mates were not primarily fighting for their country, much less the flag, but they were fighting for each other. This is putting people ahead of ideology, and that's usually a good thing. When Jesus said, "Come unto me, all ye that labour and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest," he was not addressing those of you who are bamboozled by ultimate metaphysical questions, which is the stuff of ideology, but to those who are wearied by the everyday demands of life. So when the Apostle John wrote of the true God in 1 John 5:20, he was not speaking about God as ultimate reality. He was speaking about God as the dependable, reliable, faithful one. God as the true mate. Similarly, while family first is a great corrective to family neglect and to putting corporate profits ahead of family happiness, that's not an infallible guide to action. We have here a genuine difference between the sexes, which seems to be necessary for the survival of civilization. In a disaster situation, apparently, women will always attempt to rescue the members of their own families first, whereas men seem to be in the business of rescuing everybody. Men have a broader vision than women about what is required practically for the good of all, and they rightly insist that to invest everything in your family is neither in their interests nor the community's. Insofar as mateship witnesses to the value of a wider interdependence beyond one's own company and even the company of one's own wife and family, it is worth honouring. So thank you, mates.